Today we're going to take a little bit of a shift. We're still talking about human factors, but instead of talking about actually how it influences function, that is certain activities that occur in relation to certain places, today we're going to be talking about meaning, a notion that we communicate through architecture. Architecture has meaning. It says something. It makes us understand something. And so it's a communication device. And I would argue that we are at the moment in an era when communication visually is maybe at something of a peak. We probably have never in the history of mankind been so dependent on visual communication. And part of this is a whole, you know, maybe 40 or 50 years of media dependency, so that we're very accustomed to seeing photographs, publications, magazines, books, television, films. Now the internet, all of those things barrage us constantly with images. And we absorb those images extremely well at this point. And in fact, there's lots of really cool studies about your brain structure recently. And in fact, we have rewired our brains in the last couple of decades so that the visual part of our brain is actually way, way, way more developed than it has been in previous eras. And if you look at a human brain of someone in the U.S. right now who's very internet savvy and uses it all the time, the visual part of their brain is way, way, way more developed than, let's say, someone living in a traditional community in a rural area in South America. We have stimulated that part of our brain so thoroughly that all of those neurons have wired together to give us much greater capability in absorbing visual images quickly and getting messages from them. Concurrent with that, we probably have lost a little of our ability to deal with the written word and our ability to actually absorb text and do deep reading has actually diminished in the last decade or so. But wow, visually, we have really hyped up our capabilities. I can see that in this class. I would say 20 years ago when I gave slide identification, I got a really nice bell curve out of that. A lot of people just clueless, just could not remember images. These days, not a problem. You guys have played tons of video games. You guys have, since you were little kids, been very savvy to absorbing lots of images, keeping them in your memory, recalling them. You're good at this. Few exceptions, but mostly this is not something that's difficult for you because you've wired your brain to absorb visual messages. Now, we all communicate with those visual messages all the time. We do it unconsciously, a lot like I've talked about in many aspects of this course, that it's more unconscious. But when you got up this morning, you probably looked in the mirror and you adjusted the way you looked to give another visual message other than what you saw in the mirror when you woke up. Maybe you combed your hair to make it more orderly. Maybe you mussed up your hair to make it more crazy. Maybe you put on some makeup. Maybe you selected certain clothes that seemed to be right for what you were going to be doing today. All of these things communicate messages all the time. If you look buttoned down, put together, thoroughly groomed, that says something about who you are as a person. If you look rough and ready, totally, sort of, unkempt, whatever, that communicates something else about you. If someone came to class every day in a coat and tie And I have had students in class who came to class every freaking day in a coat and tie, a guy your age, you know, not me, a guy your age, comes to class every day in a coat and tie. That says something. You would think about that person a little different if they're sitting next to you in a coat and tie every day. If one of the female students came in a kind of, you know, really nice business suit every day, you know, skirt, jacket, heels, hose. Wow, that would say something, wouldn't it? That would communicate something visually. We do this all the time. Every single moment of our lives, we're sending and we're absorbing visual messages. And it's a communications tool. Now, corporations, companies in America, they know this really, really well. And they spend a whole lot of time worrying about how they're communicating with you. I visited the Johnson Wax Building in Racine, Wisconsin, which is a Frank Lloyd Wright building. I'm going to see the building. But, you know, the guy that's showing me around, he wants to show me this one conference room, which is a really special conference room, but they're having a meeting in there. So he said, okay, let's just quietly walk in and stand on the side of the room, and you can look at the room. So I went in there, and I'm looking at the room, but they're also having a meeting in there, maybe 15 guys sitting around a conference table. And in the center of the conference table are about 15 different versions of a can of Pledge, the stuff you spray on your furniture to dust it. I don't even know who uses Pledge anymore. But anyway, they got 15 versions of Pledge there. And they're all different. And they're having this serious conversation, serious, dead serious conversation about exactly that color of green, or that color of green combined with that color of yellow, or whether that will pop off the shelf, or whether that will disappear in, you know, on the grocery shelf with 10,000 other products that are sitting there. What will it say about Pledge? What will it say about our lemon scent? If we do it yellow, will it communicate more about our lemon scent, which is so special about Pledge? We've got to communicate visually our lemon scent, which, of course, you can communicate visually. And if you do it red, it doesn't say lemon scent. If you do it yellow or green, either of those will say something about lemon scent. We use these messages all the time, and corporate America totally gets that. Even the logo of a corporation, wow, it is so, so, so important to them. So like those blocky blue letters for IBM, IBM, International Business Machines. That logo was defined for them decades ago when they made business machines like typewriters. But that clarity, that order, that rigor, that precision, that color of blue, that blocky technological-looking letter, that defined that company. And whether they're making typewriters, or whether they're making software, or whether they're making computers, or whether they're making management systems, that logo says what that company is. And we all get a message from IBM. Likewise, think totally differently, the logo for McDonald's. Big, loopy, yellow letters, silly, goofy, Ronald McDonald-y kinds of letters, happy, cheery, kitty. And again, that defines that company. That tells us who they are and what their products are about and who they're talking to. This is huge in corporate America. How many of you have read the book by Malcolm Gladwell, Blink? Man, that is a damn good book. You ought to read that book. It's a really cool book. But there's a couple of chapters in there about visual communication. And the whole notion of that book is how we get these impressions, just blink, we get an impression. And that really sets how we think about something. But he talks about the difference between two different kinds of brandy. Christian Brothers and E&B brandy. And in a taste test, E&B waxed Christian Brothers, just waxed them. Everybody thought it was much better tasting brandy. But when it got on the shelf, Christian Brothers sold way more brandy than E&B. And the reason is because it's in a fancy-ass bottle, really cool shape, really glittery gold kind of seal. You know, it looks regal, it looks fancy, it looks expensive. It doesn't taste as good, but it sells like hotcakes. Because we don't buy our brandy for taste. We buy our brandy because we buy according to visual communication. And it's communicating something visually that makes it fly off the shelf. He talks about also imperial margarine. We're talking about freaking margarine, fake butter here, right? And the company's not doing that great. So then they decide to change their name to Imperial. Whoa, empire, royalty, imperial, imperial margarine. And then they make their packaging gold, kind of shiny gold. And their emblem is a little crown. And sales rocketed. Everybody wants imperial margarine. It's freaking fake butter. But, you know, it seems like it's for kings. It's expensive. It's important. All of that's just communicated visually. No one's saying all of that. They don't have to make that claim. They just put that visual message out there and you suck it up. We all suck it up. So if that's true in the way we dress, and that's true in a logo for a company, and it's true in the packaging or the objects that they send to us, of course that kind of communication is incredibly important in something as big and as pervasive and as much a part of our visual field everywhere as architecture is. So we're going to talk about three different ways that architecture communicates messages. And then we'll look at some examples that bear that out. So I would say the most sort of easy, simple, common way is we have literal direct communication. Literal direct communication. We see something that is literally what we're meant to think about, and that is directly communicated to you. An example of that is if we had a billboard on I-35 and it said, "Eat more beef," and it had a picture of a big old Hereford cow. That cow is a representation of beef. It is literally a cow. And here you are meant to think about cow, beef. So that is literal direct communication, and we use that all the time. A second kind of communication is what we might call literal indirect communication. We're seeing something literal. It's a recognizable object. But we're not supposed to think about that object. It's meant to remind us of something else. It's indirect. And again, you could think of a billboard on I-35, and it has a picture of a cow, but this time the cow is a longhorn steer. And it says, "Go horns." Now, it's literally a cow, but we're not supposed to be thinking about cows at all, actually. We're thinking about the University of Texas. We're thinking about sports. We're thinking about all kinds of things that honestly have nothing to do with cows. But that literal cow is up there, but it indirectly represents something we associate with that cow. That is Bevo, University of Texas. And there are tons of you all over the room who have that literal indirect communication on your t-shirt or on your lanyard for whatever that's supposed to be, your keys, or for on your cap or whatever. Those are literal indirect communication. It's emblematic of something else. And then the third way we communicate is abstract communication. And this is just by the shape of it or the color of it. These give us feelings. Abstractly, we get an impression by whatever color it is. And there, you know, you might have, let's say, there might be possible to have a billboard that was just certain colors and certain shapes and certain images, not anything literal, that might communicate, say, the University of Texas. The color orange would be a good start on that. But that's abstract communication. Okay, so let's start with a few examples. And we're first going to look at literal direct communication. And the first example we're looking at is a series of temples in Khajuraho in India. And these are ancient, ancient temples. They were done between 930 and 1050 AD. There probably are 40 or 50 of these temples in this little area around Khajuraho. Khajuraho is just a tiny little town. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's not near a big city. There's just this interesting, and they're actually clustered in little smaller precincts, like maybe 10 of them here and 8 of them there and 16 of them here. And they're the little precincts of Hindu temples. And at this point, people come from all over India, mostly not from outside India. They're still very much a Hindu site. So if you're Hindu, you might make a pilgrimage to these temples to visit them, but not very many Westerners go to Khajuraho. It's absolutely one of my favorite places in India. I've been there twice, and I'm going to tell you the story of why these occurred and what they mean in two completely different ways. The first one is the way I experienced the first time I visited there, and the second one is the way I experienced the second time I visited there. So these are incredibly elaborate things. They obviously took thousands and thousands of people, you know, long periods of time to make them. They're covered in carved stone, just incredibly elaborate carving. Interestingly, there's really not much inside to these things. You don't think, it's not like our churches where you go inside and everybody sits down and you have some kind of service. That's not how they worship in Hindu religion. So the insides, there's not much to them, really. They're kind of dark and they're kind of small. It's the outside. And it really is that communication. It's like a billboard. It's like something that's telling you a message. And they were built for that purpose. And they've been around for 1,000 years telling this message to people about the Hindu religion. And so there are two different interpretations of that message that I'm going to tell you. The first one was told to me by the guy who was my driver when I visited this site in the early 1980s. And this guy was a very tall, robust, kind of burly Indian guy. Drove an old, like 20-year-old black Ford that was beat to shit. And, you know, you just barely get around. I was poor at that time. You can't really drive yourself in India. That's crazy. So you have to get a driver, but I don't have any money, so I get this. And you it's not like you can take a bus or a train to Khajuraho, at least not at that point. So I had to get this driver to take me out there. And so this driver and I get to be kind of buddies, and we talk about, he's Hindu, he's all over Khajuraho, very important site for him. Just to give you a sense of this guy, he very, very proud of his wife and his family. He's just, you know, told me how what a wonderful wife he had, and, you know, how she's so much a part of his life. And just to prove to me how amazing his wife was, he takes out a picture and he shows it to me, and he very proudly says, "She can carry 100 pounds on her head." Dude, you have a great wife. Whoa, amazing. Okay, so that's the culture we're a part of here. And I'm not very knowledgeable about Hindu religion or these temples. And he says, "Let me explain to you what these mean, what these temples mean and how they came about." So he said that there were In the old times, 1,000 years ago, there were wealthy people in the area, and there were poor people in the area. A very small number of wealthy people. The wealthy people would send their sons to be raised by the priest, by the Hindu priest. They were very, very devout Hindus. And if you could afford to, you would, at a very young age, like 2 or 3 years old, you would take your sons and you would send them to the temple, and the priest would raise the sons. And the priests were celibate priests. They didn't have sex. And so then the young men would become very, very, very devout Hindus. Their whole life was about the religion. And they began to associate celibacy, as the priest practiced, with devotion to this religion. And then at about age 14 or 15, they would be returned back home, and there would be an arranged marriage. And they would be married to maybe a girl that was 12 or 13 years old. And then they would be put together to consummate the marriage. And then they would live thereafter as a married couple. Well, that wasn't working out that great. Turned out they just weren't producing any babies in this system. So one problem was the young men thought of celibacy as a wonderful religious expression. They were put with these girls when they were kind of not horny enough to overcome that that notion. And so it turned out they were married to each other, but they lived kind of separate lives in their households, and, you know, no babies happened. And this was a problem, because the rich people aren't having babies, and there isn't a next generation. And if there isn't a next generation, there aren't any kids to send to the Hindu school. If there aren't any kids to send to the Hindu school, the priests don't have any work. You know, this is bad for everybody, bad for the priests, bad for the wealthy people. It's just not working out. Meanwhile, the poor people are breeding like rabbits, so there's not a problem there. But among the wealthy leaders, they're not getting a next generation. So the sort of wealthy leaders go to the priests and say, we've got to have a solution to this problem. And the priest said, absolutely, we get it. And they thought of how could we could make a solution to this problem. Now, they didn't want to reduce the devotion of these young men at all. They wanted to keep them devoted. But they also wanted to let them know that sexuality was not competitive with that devotion. You could be sexually aroused and be devoted to your Hindu religion at the same time. So they built these temples, and they carved these stories in the temples, and they made beautiful depictions of women, very, very sexual depictions of women, and they covered these temples with these images of men and women, and they began to use them in a way to instruct the young men about sexuality. And sometimes it got to be about even a little more than procreation. Let's say recreational sex, maybe even athletic sex. This one right here, bottom right, don't try that at home. So there are, covering these temples, there are these depictions of human sexuality. And it made the message extremely clear. It's a Hindu temple. We go here to worship. Worship, devotion, sexuality, desire, satisfaction, all of those things, they go together. And you can see in the faces and in the hand gestures of these figures this kind of sense of a combination of ecstasy in religion and ecstasy in sexuality. Now, that was what my driver swore to me, was the story of how these temples came about and what they meant. And what they meant to him was religion, sex, yeah. Okay, they're great, they're together, they're the same. And, you know, when I'm having this great sex with my wife, I'm being a good Hindu. Yes! And that was kind of embedded in the religion. Now, that was the first time I visited there. I went back there a couple of years ago. And, you know, I was traveling a little better than I did the earlier time. And I actually arranged to talk to a Brahmin. The Brahmin are the priestly caste in India. And his father had been a very, very famous yogi, had traveled all over the world lecturing and teaching. So this was a very, very learned man. And he explained to me what the temples mean in another part of the culture, not the hoi polloi, but in a more elevated, more intellectual sense, what these mean. And he said that there are four aspects of life in the Hindu religion. And he was very clear to me that the Hindu religion is not like Christianity. The Hindu religion is almost not like a religion. It's a way of life. It's about every single aspect of your life. And it's not something you can sort of put in a box. It's absolutely pervasive in your life. And so there are four things that they deal with in Hindu religion. There is artha, which is duty, what you're responsible for in your life. Sorry, there's dharma, I think, which is duty. There is artha, which is getting material wealth. It's money. It's gaining stature from material wealth. And there is kama, which is sexuality. And you know the Kama Sutra, which was written by a Hindu priest in the 4th century. Kama Sutra, which is essentially instructions about sexuality. That is about kama, which is sexuality. And the fourth thing is nirvana, which is salvation. So dharma, artha, kama, and nirvana, or duty, material gain, sexuality, and salvation. And that's what life is about. Those are all, that encompasses all aspects of life. And so in a Hindu temple, there are many Hindu temples that have statues that depict duty. And there are many Hindu temples that are dedicated more to material gain. And it's very interesting, acquisition of animals and harvesting of crops and marketing of things. You see those depicted in Hindu temples. And also certainly nirvana, that is depicted in the temples as well. So of course, so would sexuality be depicted. And this particular complex is devoted to kama, which is one of those four sort of cornerstones of Hindu religion. And so it's only right and normal, because Hindu religion is about life. Sexuality is a part of life. It becomes a part of the temple. You know, both messages are not in contradiction to each other, but it's interesting to hear from two completely different kinds of individuals from different economic classes and the meaning that these temples have. Now, they still have that meaning. And if you go on a normal day there, you'll see thousands of Hindus there walking around, looking at these temples, looking at these statues, giggling, kind of high, but appreciating, getting messages from these temples. This is literal direct communication. Literally, sexuality. Direct. What am I supposed to think about? Sexuality is a normal part of life. Sexuality is a part of religion. Religion is the whole of life. There's a pervasiveness of all of this. It's all together, and that's what my religion, and that's what my life, and it's all together, and that's what it means. And it's depicted in literal direct communication. Okay, let's look at literal indirect communication. Now, in this case, we're looking at something, and we're meant to see that as literally something, but we're meant to have associations with that. We get indirect messages. In this case, we're looking at the University of Virginia, campus, the original portion of that campus that was designed by Thomas Jefferson between 1817 and 1825. Most of you know the name Thomas Jefferson. He is, of course, a very famous architect who lived in Virginia in the latter part of the 18th century, early part of the 19th century. He was an extraordinarily good architect, probably the best architect in the colonies and then the young republic in that period of time. He had studied architecture very vociferously. He had many, many, many books on architecture. When he had traveled in France, he had made very specific journeys to study great works of architecture and to make himself very erudite, very well-versed, very learned in architecture. And then he came back and he did a number of very famous buildings, his own home at Monticello, the campus at the University of Virginia, the state capitol for Virginia, many houses in that area, a really accomplished architect. You may also know he had a hobby or a kind of sideline where he was a politician, wrote the Declaration of Independence, was president of the United States, but that's kind of minor. That was a side thing he did. Primarily, of course, Thomas Jefferson was an architect. After he finished being president in 1808, he had tried, when he was president, to get Congress to create a national university. He believed that democracy depended on education, that you couldn't have people govern themselves if they weren't educated to govern themselves. And he felt like absolutely essential to that whole process was that you have university education and that it be available to people. So he failed. Congress would not, cheap-ass Congress, would not appropriate the money for a national university. So after he stopped being president in 1808, he returned back to Virginia, his home state, and he lobbied very heavily with the Virginia legislature to get them to establish a state university. And he was successful in that, and he got Virginia to establish the first state university in the United States, which was the University of Virginia. And then he dedicated the rest of his life to creating the University of Virginia, creating its curriculum, hiring its faculty, and creating the buildings for that university. He understood completely that the nature of the university, what it said, what it was, what it became, would be essentially, very, very essentially, based in what physical environment was created for that university. So from 1808 until he died in 1826, he spent most of his time working on the University of Virginia, and for a good part of that time, for 7-8 years, in the construction of the campus itself. And he was defining here, as he did for his whole life, being a politician, being a statesman, and being an architect were actually the same thing, because he was trying to figure out what is democracy? What is democracy? What is self-governance? What is this whole philosophy? And then how do I promote it? And I promote it in architecture just exactly as I promote it in writing the Declaration of Independence or in passing laws or policy. That it's both of those are ways of expressing an idea, conveying an idea, having an impact on a culture to embody this idea. So if you're thinking of public education, you're thinking of democracy, you're thinking of empowerment, you're thinking of how do we make individuals self-reliant, how do you communicate that through the architecture? And he made a decision early in his design process of this to hark back to a building that everyone would have known, every educated person would have known. Now, in this culture, what education meant primarily was classical education. So he had himself received a classical education. That meant that you studied Greek and Latin, classical languages, that you read Plato and Socrates, and you read philosophers that were from that culture, and that you studied the art and the architecture of Greece and Rome and of the classical cultures. That was where Western civilization came from. And so an educated person would have been very immersed in classical sources. So he goes back to a classical source, to a building in Rome that was built by Hadrian, one of the great emperors of Rome, one of the great Caesars. Hadrian was the biggest builder of any of the Caesars. He built many amazing buildings. And really, when we go to Rome today and we see Roman architecture, a great deal of it is influenced by Hadrian. And one of Hadrian's great accomplishments was the Pantheon, which we're seeing on the left right here. The Pantheon was built in Rome in 120 AD by Hadrian, and it is an iconic building in Roman architecture. So if you were a young man being trained in classical education in the 18th century, as Thomas Jefferson was, you would certainly have known the Pantheon in Rome, this great emblem and icon of Roman life and culture. So he decides, I'm going to borrow the image of the Pantheon in Rome, and I'm going to make it the image for the main building, the library, at the University of Virginia. Now, what did that mean? And I'm going to say it has four primary meanings. The first meaning is it relates the United States in the 19th century to Rome in the 2nd century. And that's very important. We're a fledgling country, weak, barely getting started. But to set yourself as a parallel to, or compare yourself to, or have aspirations to be like Rome, to be like this powerful nation that essentially ruled the world, that says something. We're like Rome. We're powerful like Rome. We aspire to be powerful like Rome. The other thing is, Rome was the Republic. It was a kind of democracy. It had a Senate. It had representative government. It was one of the first, you know, societies to have a kind of sophisticated version of representative government. That's what we were trying to do in the United States. It's saying our roots are in Rome. This powerful nation that was a republic, that had a Senate, that had representation, that's who we're like. So when you go to study at the University of Virginia, you understand that I'm a part of this big thing, this big enterprise that's been going on since Rome, and now we're the latest manifestation of that. That's literal indirect meaning. Literally, it's the Pantheon. Indirectly, it's talking to you about power. It's talking to you about position in the world stage. It's talking to you about democracy, about representative government, about republic, all of those things. So that's one strong message. A second very strong message has to do with what the Pantheon was itself in Rome. So the problem that Hadrian was addressing was that there were lots and lots of gods in Roman religion. So there was a whole bunch of people who worshipped Athena. She was the goddess of love. And so there would be the temple to Athena, and there would be a kind of cult that followed Athena. And then there'd be another cult that would follow Apollo, and there'd be another one that would follow Mars, and there'd be another one that would follow Neptune. And these people would be into the sea and into Neptune as the sea god, and they'd go to the temple of Neptune, and they had all these little religions that were competing with each other. Sort of like maybe, you know, the Catholics and the Baptists and the Episcopalians and the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the New Agers, or, you know, but a little bit competitive there. And Hadrian was disturbed by this because he felt like we should be unified as a Roman people. Religion should not be splitting us apart. Religion should be pulling us together and unifying us. So he built the Pantheon, which means pan-theon. Pan means all or inclusive. Theon means the gods. So the Pantheon was a temple to all of the gods. And he built it, and he built it as the most magnificent, the most amazing temple anybody would ever have seen, and trying to encourage people not to go to their local little culty temple, but to come to the pantheon and see that there is a unification here of all the gods. It was about unification. It was bringing people with differences together. Now, that's exactly the challenge in Virginia in the early part of the 19th century. The United States was still individual states. People in New York were incredibly competitive with the people in Virginia, and they were completely competitive with the people in Massachusetts. And their economies seemed to be warring with each other. Even the people in Western Virginia were very different from the people in Eastern Virginia. They were frontiersmen, and in Eastern Virginia, they were plantation owners. Their economies were different. Their desires were different. They tended to be arguing and fighting and splitting with each other. And what Jefferson thought was essential was unification. We're all in this together. And so he wanted the university to be a place where it unified the culture. And so he's talking about the pantheon because it's for all the gods. And he's making this expression at the University of Virginia about all the people, about people who are rich people or people who are not so rich people, about Western frontiersmen, about Eastern plantation owners, about people from New York or people from Massachusetts. We're all in this together. So the second big message was about unification. The third message was about a sense of community, a sense of dialogue, a sense of conversation. Jefferson felt like the way we're going to make progress is we have to talk to and understand each other. And he was very interested in this forum that was in the front of the Pantheon in Rome. That doesn't exist today. Today there's a little piazza in front of the Pantheon, and then the buildings are much, much closer to the Pantheon than they used to be. But in the original city, when Hadrian laid it out, there was this big rectangular forum in front of the Pantheon. And along the sides of the forum were the stoa, and these were places where there were little shops. And then in the center was the place where people had conversation. That's where there were debates on public issues. That's where there were demonstrations. That's where, when the politicians were trying to get elected, that's where they made their campaign speeches. This was the kind of public forum in Rome, was the forum in front of the Pantheon. And Thomas Jefferson, likewise at University of Virginia, made what's now called the lawn in front of that main building, the library at University of Virginia, as a place for conversation. And along the sides, he put all of the pavilions. The pavilions housed mathematics, English, Latin, philosophy. All the different disciplines were housed in individual pavilions. And then the conversation between all of them happened in the lawn in the center. So the third meaning was to say, just as the forum in front of the Pantheon was a place for conversation or dialogue or communication, so at the University of Virginia, there is this place for dialogue or communication or a sense of community that's there as well. That's the third message. And then the fourth message has to do with this idea of library knowledge as a kind of temple. Why did you put the big prominent building as the library? Because Jefferson, deep, deep in his heart, believed that education and knowledge and learning, that was his religion. He actually was not a very religious man, but in a conventional sense. But he believed that that was what sustained human psyche and philosophy and so on. So just as this had been a monumental, powerful temple, so the library was to be this monumental, powerful place where people would go to learn. And the very strong emblem of it as the center of this little community of the university. So we have these four things that it's communicating. All of them by literal indirect communication. It is literally the Pantheon. It is literally even the urban condition of the Pantheon. But you're not meant just to think of the pantheon. You're to think of those characteristics of the pantheon. You're to think of the democracy of Rome. You're to think of power of Rome to unify itself. You're to think of the sense of dialogue and communication that existed in Rome. And you're to think of this as a kind of temple or religious place where you keep books and where you keep knowledge and where you learn. So there is the main building, the library, at the end of the lawn, and then along the side there are the various pavilions, each pavilion slightly different from the other, all of them unified by this continuous arcade or walkway that takes you around. In each of these pavilions, there would have been a professor, say the professor of mathematics, that lived upstairs with his family. And then on the lower floors would have been the classrooms and the study spaces. And then in the spaces in between the pavilions, there would have been the student rooms that opened onto that arcade, and then there's another rank of student rooms behind that that also give a kind of second layer of access to the lawn. And all of that is all perfectly intact today. It is still used in many ways the same way by the University of Virginia. Students still live in those student quarters that were there. The pavilions tend not, there's still some faculty members that live in the pavilions. Architecture has one of the pavilions, as they have had for ages, and usually the dean of the School of Architecture lives there. But some of the pavilions are used for other purposes as well. But it still functions very much with that meaning, and it still says the primacy of learning in the library. It still says those things about our origins in Greece and Rome. A lot of that is still there and very meaningful. I think it was very powerful in establishing what the University of Virginia was about. And still to this day, as they refer to Mr. Jefferson, is a major figure as if he still were lording over that campus. Okay, literal indirect communication. Let's look at another way that works. Certainly works in the case of the University of Virginia. In this case, we're looking at a kind of literal indirect communication that transfers over time within a building type. How do we look at a building and say, oh, that's a beautiful church? We look at a building and say, oh, that's a, you know, that's a school. Oh, that's a university. Oh, that's a business enterprise. And there are ways that we communicate the function of a building by these kind of codes. And so we're going to look for a little bit here at a series of town halls over a long period of time, and how a building type develops certain codes that let you know that function, what that building does. And even in a bigger symbolic sense, what's the role of that, the occupant of that, in the larger culture that it's a part of. So we're going to start with these town halls, these places that have civic government. And the first of these we want to look at is the Doge's Palace in Venice. Venice would have been a city-state, that is, and this was common in the Mediterranean era, really up until the Renaissance, where it was really about cities, even in the Renaissance. Florence was the kind of capital of a city-state. Siena was the capital of a city-state. Venice was the capital of a city-state. So the city was very, very important for kind of reigning over a whole region. And the governor or the mayor or the major figure of the city of Venice was the Doge. And so this was the Doge's palace where the Doge lived and then where government was organized. So we're looking at that building, which is the Doge's palace right there. Now, there are five things that I think characterize this building and would come to characterize this center of civic government in many, many buildings subsequently. The first of them is that there was a major tower put as part of the ensemble with the Doge's palace. It's called the Tor San Marco, and it sits right there, and it says, this is the center of the city. It's very clear communication, this major vertical monument. It says this is the center of the city. So having the government right next to the center, that makes a whole lot of sense, and the tower is a very important emblem. The second thing is what I'm going to call a focal balcony. It's what's happening right here. It's what's happening right there, right there. And the focal balcony actually had a function. It was about there being a kind of issue that was being adjudicated inside the building. The Doge would be working with other people in the government, and at a certain point a decision would be made, and way back in these times long ago, the way it would be communicated to the people was the Doge would come out on the balcony, and they would make an announcement to the people gathered below, either in the piazza or in the piazzetta. So these focal balconies were about a kind of pronouncement. And they stood there as an emblem of this is where the Doge comes, and he makes those pronouncements. This is where there's a communication. Even in recent weeks, we've all been looking at St. Peter's in Rome, and the Pope, you know, when they have a new Pope, he comes out on the balcony, and nowadays we have TV, we have radio, we have internet, we have all kinds of other ways to communicate. But there still is the freaking Pope out there on the balcony, you know, making some kind of, he did on Easter, he said his little service from the balcony out there. That goes back to this notion that the building needed to become an emblem for the communication between what goes on inside and the people outside. So the building has these focal balconies. The third thing is that it is very dominantly made of arcades. This big open area at the bottom of the building. And that's really saying, you know, you people in the public outside, you can be a part of this building too. You can circulate and move around and have your activities kind of inside the building. So it's penetrable. And it's semi-public, semi-private. It's got an interface between the public space and the stuff that happens inside. So the arcade is a very, very important element here. And here it's an element not just functionally where the people move in and out, but sort of symbolically, this penetrability of the whole bottom of the building where it meets the city. The fourth aspect of it is that it's built around a courtyard. And that courtyard in the center was a place where small groups of the public would come in and gather and communicate something to the Doge. So, I don't know, 100 people who were in the Leather Workers Guild would come in and they'd lobby for whatever they wanted for their guild. But the courtyard was a place where you weren't all the way inside the building, but you were kind of inside the building. And the courtyard was very important for that as well, for the function and for the role of the building. And then the fifth thing is this whole notion of stairs. There's stairs in the courtyard. There's stairs on the outside of the building. This whole notion of something being elevated. Very grand stair that takes you up to a higher level where important things happen. So it elevates certain functions. It takes them up there, and the stair becomes an emblem of that. So in the Doge's palace, it's using these elements, the tower, the focal balcony, the courtyard, the stair, the arcade, as a way to communicate what it is we're doing in this building and how it relates to everyone outside. And then in these early town halls, there begin to be that vocabulary exercise. And the next one that gets built kind of learns from the previous one. And in the Renaissance, a couple of hundred years later, we have Michelangelo working in Rome. Rome's another one of those city-states. And they're building the center of the city government in Rome. It's called the Campidoglio, and it's on the Capitoline Hill, so it's up on the top of a hill, right in the center of the town. There's 7 hills in Rome. The Capitoline Hill is kind of the biggest one. And then on top of that hill, they put the building, the sort of ensemble of buildings, and a very important part of it is the tower, which we can see from the forum area over here. We can see from the opposite side over here. The tower is kind of the culmination of everything. You go up this axis, the tower is always in front of you. From all over the city, you see the tower. It says, this is the center of our city. This is where government happens. Again, the tower is an important thing. The stairs, we're on a freaking hill, of course, so we got to get up there, and we have all these stairs. And it's all about elevation, elevating it, important, move up. And the stairs are very prominent in the Capitolio. There is this idea of arcade. So the building is very open at the bottom. The people can move in. And even this kind of emblematic arcade. So it's almost like two-story columns. And even though those are rooms, there's a sense of it being penetrable in there. These are facades that were made by Michelangelo and very much about getting the arcade to bring people in. There is, of course, the focal balcony, the moment where the mayor of the city can come out, stand on that balcony, make a pronouncement to the people gathered below. So that focal balcony becomes a very much a part of the ensemble. The axis of the tower and the focal balcony and the stair leading up to it, all of those working together. And then also, so we had the arcade, the courtyard. All three buildings kind of make an ensemble. The sort of main building, and these two flanking buildings with the arcades on either side, and they make a great central court. And they have then a statue of Marcus Aurelius, one of their great heroes, in the center of it. And that says, again, that the people can come in and penetrate that and be a kind of subset of this larger city government. So again, same five elements. We can even go into the 20th century, very much the same thing happening. Stockholm, Sweden builds themselves a brand new monumental city hall, a big gesture for the city in the 1920s. The architect Ragnar Östberg uses all these same elements. This is on an island in the archipelago that is sort of where Stockholm is located. So because it's got water around it a lot, it needs to make a landmark for itself. So the tower is a very, very prominent element that lets you see this is where city government occurs. On that tower, there are these little focal balconies. Now they're just kind of remnants, because even by the 1920s, we got radio, we got newspapers. It's not like the people are going to gather out here and wait for the mayor to make a pronouncement. But we still have those emblematic focal balconies that are occurring there. We have the arcade, which you can see through here. We have the courtyard. It's built around a courtyard. We have the stairs that take you up to the sort of elevated chambers there. Because we're in a really cold climate in Stockholm, you not only gather in the outdoor courtyard when it's reasonable weather, but there even is an indoor courtyard, a place, a room inside that feels like it's outdoors and has that feeling of a courtyard. And it's also surrounded by an arcade. So those emblems come right into the building. So again, tower, focal balcony, courtyard, stair, and this incredible arcade. And that one now actually penetrates all the way under the building and connects the water and the sea, which is very much a part of Stockholm, back into that courtyard and deep into the building, and lets you get a sense of the penetrability, the publicness of what's going on here. So that in the early 20th century, even the mid-20th century, we're still using those same vocabularies, even in a very modern building. This is the Boston City Hall, where again we have elements like the focal balcony. Now, of course, we don't need it for pronouncements, but that's the council chamber behind that gesture right there. This is the mayor's office behind that gesture right there. Different vocabulary, but the same notion of a focal balcony. The whole building is set up off the ground on these piloti or piers. There's a sense of that penetrability of the public into it, exactly as we saw in those earlier city halls. It's built around a courtyard, that courtyard surrounded by the building, and with stairs that take you, elevate you, and take you to that raised courtyard. And then from that courtyard into those raised elements of the council chamber and the mayor's office and so on. And that stair very prominent on the outside as you grandly move up to the courtyard and into the other major public spaces of the building. So whatever era, this is literal indirect communication. We know these emblems stand for City Hall. And you can see that in hundreds and hundreds of city halls all over the world. In particular in the 19th and 20th century, where there were, it was kind of de rigueur. That's how you made a city hall. And we could do the same thing with schools, with churches, with libraries. There even are within churches sometimes these codes of, oh, that looks like a Baptist church. Oh, that looks like an Episcopalian church. And certainly in the 1920s and 1930s, if you were a Baptist church, you did Georgian architecture. That was what you associated with. American, colonial, those kinds of things. If you were Episcopalian, that was the Church of England, you didn't talk about America, you talked about Europe, you had Gothic architecture. And those were transfer of meaning, literal, indirect. Now, the other way we talked about conveying meaning is abstract, where now we're not trying to make you think of something literally. It's just about feelings. It's about what certain shapes or what certain colors or certain light qualities might convey to you. This was a brand new cathedral that was being built for San Francisco. It was one of the very first cathedrals that had been built in the United States in many, many years. It was built in the 1970s. The architect was Pietro Belluschi. He teamed with a very, very famous engineer, Pierluigi Nervi, Italian guy, and they created this brand new cathedral. And, you know, if you go to San Francisco, this is not on the normal tourist track, but I will tell you, this one blows you away. This is an amazing building. So does it have a steeple? Does it have a... Is it Gothic? Is it Georgian? No, none of those associations. Wipe all that clean. We're not talking about literal at all. We're just kind of reinventing, what does religion feel like? What does it mean? And there is something in the outside that is emotional, that feels like religion. We know this is probably not an office building. This is not a multifamily residential unit. This is probably about something spiritual, mystical, emotional, by the kind of shapiness of the building, the sculptural quality of it. It also is very much about ascension. It rises to the heavens. It engages the heavens. There's something in that that feels religious, spiritual, talking about God. Even the color, the sort of whiteness, the purity, that says something about kind of religion, seeking cleansing, redemption. These are abstract qualities that we associate positively with religion, and the building really emanates out of those. Inside, it is amazingly dramatic. These are great hyperbolic paraboloid vaults that have these kind of triangular coffers in them. And the light comes through this beautiful, rich stained glass that goes between these hyperbolic paraboloids. And the glass was all designed by Georgi Kepish, who was trained in the Bauhaus, taught at MIT, was actually one of my professors when I was in school. Beautiful, rich colors, and the light and the color and the shape of those bending, undulating planes. Very spiritual, very ethereal. And then in the center of the whole thing is this great piece of sculpture that's made of thousands and thousands of shards of stainless steel. And the light comes down and sparkles on those shards of stainless steel, and they hang kind of magically in that space, just hovering, almost like an apparition, almost like a spirit, something you see but you can't grab. That's like religion. So the building, the sculpture, the shapes, the colors, the reflection, the light, all of those things are speaking about religion. But all of this is in a very abstract way. Now, we respond very unconsciously often, but we respond to these characteristics in buildings, and they carry meaning with them. Right close to home here, I would encourage you to take a look at the LBJ Library and Museum. That one was built at exactly the same time as that building in San Francisco. And again, it's on an abstract level. You're building a presidential library. There weren't but like two or three presidential libraries at that point. We were inventing a new building type. How do you make a presidential library? What does it say? What does it say about the presidency? What does it say about power? What does it say in particular about LBJ? I'm actually reading now the fourth in this series of books on LBJ by Robert Caro. And each one of those is all about power. This one is The Passage to Power. It's about that transition from being powerless vice president to being powerful president. And, you know, this is a man who his entire life, if you believe Robert Caro, was just hungry for power. And he wanted to amass around him the ability to get things done, to make things happen. And maybe more than any president for the past 50, 60 years, LBJ made things happen. He got his legislation through. Obama's like really struggling to get a wimpy little, you know, gun control law through, even though the population is hugely in favor of it. He's having a really hard time getting this through. LBJ kicked butt. He knew how to get legislation through. He got civil rights legislation through that nobody else had ever been able to get through, not since 1876. This was a powerful, powerful man. How do you make an emblem? How do you make a building that talks about LBJ? How do you make a building that talks about the presidency? It's from the outside, very powerful, maybe even oppressive. When you go inside, there's that great hall in the inside. You know, all of his archives up there in little red boxes with gold seals. And you get a sense of reverence, of respect, of importance. All of those are conveyed by the scale, by the color, by the materials, this travertine we associate with Rome and powerful buildings, by the space, by the light, by the shape. All of these things conveying abstractly characteristics of LBJ, of the presidency, and of a kind of memorial to him. It's almost like a mausoleum. You kind of expect, just like Mao or Ho Chi Minh or Lenin, one of these guys where you go in and you actually see the body in there. It's not there. He's under a live oak tree in Johnson City. But you get this sense of a great figure that's residing here in some kind of way. Now, earlier in the semester, we looked at this building when we were talking about form. We could just as easily look at this building in terms of meaning. Jewish Museum in Berlin, just want to recall to that sense of the diaspora, of oppression, of Jewish people being scattered and dislocated, all those things in the building, and the fact that it opened just as a building with no exhibits for a while, and the message was there. It communicated it just through architectural form in abstract communication. Okay, quick little Twitter card question here. I've been having you think about your high school. I want you to tell me what was the meaning in your high school. In your high school, was there meaning communicated to you? It's probably okay if you think, I don't think there was any meaning, but I bet there was. What did it communicate to you and to your fellow students? What meaning was communicated by your high school? Okay, I'll see you on Thursday.